tap into it. We have to listen to our inner brain, and we have to connect with it. And so much of the world and how the world operates right now is to get us to be disconnected and to get us to be in this space. Like I said, you know, that we put so many things in place on to measure our worth and you know, constantly making us feel like we're insecure and we need this thing to function, and we don't. We have everything we need within us.
This is a podcast called Walk, Talk, Listen. An attempt to connect people and make this world a bit better by sharing opinions and experiences based on the belief that everyone's perspective is true, albeit partial. My name is Maurice Bloem, and I would like to welcome you to yet another episode of Walk, Talk, Listen. Okay, good day, everybody. This is another episode of the podcast Walk, Talk, Listen. And as always, I'm delighted with today's guest who will introduce herself. Nicole, please go ahead.
Hi, Maurice. Thank you so much for having me in your podcast. I'm really, really excited to be here and chat with you. So a little bit about myself professionally. Mm-hmm. I'm the Director of Gender Initiatives with Episcopal Relief and Development. So I oversee the program strategy portfolio of partners and activities that reduce gender-based violence and advance gender equality and social inclusion. I joined Episcopal Relief and Development in January of 2024, so very new.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, only a few months in the job. But I think I've just hit the ground running, like I've been here for years. So, but this was after 10 years of working with UNDP, UNFPA, and UN Women in Trinidad, Laos, Nepal, Lebanon, Liberia, Libya, and Tunisia. And so my background is largely in strategy planning and analysis, designing gender equality and socially inclusive focused programs that are related to peace and security, disaster risk reduction, women's political participation and leadership, women's economic empowerment in both humanitarian and developing contexts. On a more personal side, I like to think, or I usually say to people that I'm a bit of a high-functioning introvert. Really believe the personal is political. You know, I have a great interest in transgenerational transmission of trauma, and that was inspired by my ancestors who came to Trinidad through indentureship. Indentureship, for many people who don't know, is the labor that replaced slave labor after slavery was abolished in the Caribbean. And so I've spent several years and continue to actively work on breaking family cycles of generational trauma, trying to raise my kids. I have two stepkids with more indigenous love rather than colonial pain, as I like to say. And so when I'm not doing paid work, you know, I'm one of these people that have a million things going on in my head of just thinking, because I'm constantly thinking of, you know, what a fair, just and equal world would look like. How would life be if we weren't, you know, living by standards of human invented time and, you know, all the things that we've put in place to sort of measure our individual and collective worth and value? What would life look like without these things? So, yeah, it's a very active brain.
Yeah. Nicole, may I ask, so were you born and raised in Trinidad, or you were born? Oh, you were?
Yeah, so I was born in Tobago and raised in Trinidad, and I just moved to Atlanta in July of last year from Jerusalem. We lived there for 6 years.
Okay, so you have been quite in a number of places.
Yeah, I've traveled a lot. I've been very fortunate in my job, I think, to be able to experience different cultures.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about Trinidad and Tobago. Until, you know, what age did you live there? And then, you know, where did you go to school? And then we go slowly to, you know, to your UN life.
Yeah. So I lived in Trinidad all my life. I was born in Tobago, like I said, and then we moved over to Trinidad. So geographically, they're two different islands. Politically, they're one.
Yeah.
Like a twin island republic. So moved over a very early age, about three, four, around there, to Trinidad. So my parents are from Trinidad, and they grew up there, and they were from the south part. And so I went to school most of my life in Trinidad, did primary school, secondary school. We were under the British system, so we have primary, secondary, not like the US with high school and so forth.
Yeah.
And then when I finished high school, secondary school, we were very, so my family was incredibly poor. We did not have money at that time to send me to university. I grew up in a very violent home. My father was a very abusive man to my mom. And so that has a lot to do with why I do the work that I do. We can talk about that after, of course. But so growing up in that space and that kind of culture, you know, it explains a lot why I'm interested in generational trauma. But that was the background. Went to, so I didn't go to university right away. I started working. So that was just always immediately known. You know, we came from a poor family, and so we all had to work to help support each other. And so I worked for 10 years in the private sector. I worked in different companies, insurance companies, the oil sector, banking, for over 10 years period. And then I had the privilege in my last job in insurance, and in working for an insurance company associated with a bank in Trinidad, to have a boss who really saw in me that I had a lot of potential and I could be doing a lot more. And I was very smart, which I never thought of myself. And so she was actually quite inspirational in helping motivate me to go back to school. And so she was great about, you know, helping me with how to structure so I could get time off and I can able to go to school part-time. So I went back to school to do some courses to get the credits I needed to go to university. And I got, my first degree was in social work. I got a certificate in social work. Because I always knew at that point that I just wanted to help people. That's what I wanted to do with my life, to make a difference, knowing like the background that I came from, seeing women navigate a legal system, a justice system, the home environment, culture, et cetera, an economic system, and not have that kind of support. I knew I wanted to be part of making things better for people who are not just women, but for anyone who's in situations of violence, and how to help them get out of that with dignity and self-respect and so forth. And I knew I wanted to understand how that works, though, because a lot of times you hear questions of, you know, why do women stay? Why don't you just leave? And it's really not, so it's not an easy question to answer, not an easy thing to do. I saw that with my own mother, and even at a young age, when I was a teenager, I would ask the same thing, like, why don't you just leave? Why don't you just get a divorce? And it really wasn't an easy thing to do when the woman, you know, didn't have a certain standard of education, didn't have a certain amount of economic empowerment, so she wasn't able to take care of herself, and it creates this dependency. And so I've just been a fierce, fierce advocate, even with my children, to be financially independent, to be educated, so you can always take care of yourself, no matter what situation you're in, and never to have that kind of dependency. There's healthy dependency, but I think I've grown up seeing a lot of unhealthy dependency, and so always wanting my kids and even myself and my friends to you know, always be empowered to leave the situation when it's no longer serving you. And so, yeah, I had that amazing boss, and so, you know, I'm still in touch with her. I still let her know how I'm doing, because she was very inspirational in getting me to do like more with my life. Yeah. Wow.
And Nicole, a quick question about the situation at home. So two quick questions. One, do you have any siblings?
And I do.
And then, you know, what are they doing? Because I'm interested, you know, your path, we're getting to know you, and then, but, you know, you grew up then with siblings, and how did they see the situation? And then your mom ultimately got divorced or separated from your dad or not?
Yeah, so I have four siblings. Three of my elder siblings, they're all brothers. Okay. The only girl, which in my culture is not a good thing. It's not that you're spoiled or anything like that. There's a lot of responsibility that's placed on girls, home, and their expectations. Yeah. It was very much an emotional and financial support, and still am, for my mom. My mom never left my dad. They continued to stay together, and it continued to be a violent, it moved from being less of a physically violent relationship to more of an emotionally, sexually, financially abusive relationship the older we got. I think when we were younger, you know, there were many things. So like, I have no memory of my childhood at all, up until even well into my teens. I think a lot of that has to do with the trauma that we saw in the home. And, you know, it's locked away somewhere in the back of my mind. But for me, with my mom, it was, you know, it was something that I saw that a lot of women do, especially when I did social work, trying to negotiate being in that space of, you know, well, he's a good provider. If only he would just not hit me. And my mom was very much like that, because my dad was a good provider in that sense of, you know, making sure we had a roof over our head. We had food on the table. We had clothes on our back. We were, you know, had what we need to go to school. He was a good provider in that sense, but he was just an awful husband. Even as a father, he wasn't abusive towards us. It was actually my mother who was more the physical disciplinarian than my father was. My father was a womanizer. And so he cheated on my mom, and she knew. And I remember being a little girl, probably about 10 or somewhere between 10 to 11, and seeing in his car a card that he had gotten from one of his girlfriends, and just reading it at that age and just thinking something about this is not correct, and knowing that this was very wrong, and also not like debating within myself, should I tell my mom, should I not tell my mom, because I also didn't want to hurt her feelings, but she had already known. And I remember even being younger, probably 7 or 8, and seeing the phone, like, so at that time you would have the landline, you had to unplug it, and it would always be in the car. And we understood later that he kept mom as a prisoner in our home, because he had nailed all the windows shut. So we would go to school every day, and all the windows were nailed shut. He would lock the door and take the key with him so she couldn't leave, and he would take the phone out of the wall so she had no way of getting out. And I remember now looking back, and I would see those images and just wondering what was this about? Why is this happening? But not really understanding at that age what was going on. Because like I said, you know, with abusers, the violence is sometimes not in your face. It's not very direct. You know, my father is one of those who was a physically abusive person, but more he kept it away from us, so we never saw it. When my brother got older, in his sort of later teen years, almost being 20, he got physically abusive with my father. He attacked him. And this was because my mom had shared what had been going on, and it made my brother very upset. This is my younger brother. We're 2 years apart. So he's the youngest one. I'm the second to last.
Okay.
And so we grew up together in the home. He realized at that point, because it was very violently aggressive. My father was driving in our garage, and my brother came out with a stick and just started beating the car. And it was like he and my mom had to leave that night and go stay by a neighbor. But you know, what always struck me is no one ever called the police. This was something that was so normalized. Like all our neighbors knew, other neighbors, you know, they also had similar experiences. So it was something that was very much. The domestic violence is very much, and still is to an extent, a very private thing. You don't call the police, you don't get the police involved, in Trinidad at least. And I was actually the first one in my entire family, on both sides, my father's side, my mother's side, to call the police for my father. And that really changed our relationship quite a lot. But yeah, so my brother and I, my younger brother and I grew up together, because my mom and dad both had kids before. So I had three half-brothers.
Okay.
My father had two boys in his first relationship, and my mom had one boy. The eldest two, we're not in touch with. We don't have much of a relationship with. It's been kind of off and on. They feel, I think, to an extent, that my father chose my brother and I over them. My father was also very abusive to their mom, and so my mom and their mom had to sort of flee with them, and she had moved to Canada. And my father, at the time of having them, he was a much younger person, and he had said to us he felt he wasn't that mature. He didn't have the skills to take care of kids at that age. He felt the best thing to do was, you know, have send them to stay with their mom. But that also turned out to be not good. So I think there's a lot of dissonance and anger that they feel. And then my mom's son from her relationship, he still lives in Trinidad, and we very much have a wonderful relationship with him. We see him regularly, talk to him regularly. He's been great. He doesn't talk much. He's much more of an introvert than I am. He doesn't like to talk too much and dwell on the past. My father wasn't keen on my mom having a relationship with him. So my father died a few years ago in 2020.
Okay.
He died during COVID, at the height of COVID. He died from some complication. Sure. And COVID just made it worse. He had underlying conditions.
So you were not there at that time?
No, I wasn't. No. I was in Jerusalem.
Okay.
And in spite of our estranged relationship, you still feel it. Parent has died. Still an impactful thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many things that you didn't say, and the quality of the relationship. So no, I wasn't there. Everything was done virtual. The funeral, the burning, all of these things were done virtual. So I very much sort of had to go through my grieving process, very separate from my family. Which in the end, wasn't such a bad thing. My family was very much, this mentality of don't speak ill of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I really am very much the kind of person that believes very strongly in authentic relationship and authentic communication and being very real about people being flawed and we're not perfect individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really was not able to have conversations with people unless we were having a balanced conversation. He was such a great person. Because for me, it was sad that he died, but it was also a relief because, even up until he died, he was such a miserable human being towards my mother.
Mm.
It made her so horrifically, just miserable all the time. I remember being in Jerusalem and I'm still having to call the police because my father is threatening my mom. Mm. My brother, he didn't live with them at that time. He was living separate with his wife and son. And so, my father would go on these crazy binges still at that age. And it was, and we were always, and I was always being just dragged into that no matter where I was in the world. There was no way to get away from it. So, like I said, I was emotional and financial support for my mom, and I still am today. And she misses him, which to me sometimes is such a dissonance, and I'm really trying to understand that. Mm-hmm. But I think what she misses a lot is the companionship of having someone there. She feels very lonely right now. All of us moved away.
Yeah.
And she, I think for her to have sanity in that situation, she built her life around her children. And so being very invested in us and what we were doing and where we were going and who we were with and so forth. And then when all of us moved out, there was just nothing there to sustain her. So she's working now on rekindling her relationship with her son. Because like I said, my father wasn't keen on her having a relationship. So since he's died, she's able to spend a lot more time with him and her grandkids, which has been wonderful for him, for her, been very healing. And especially to spend time with her grandkids as well has been amazing. And she's really grateful for that. And I'm grateful that she has that and she's able to have that relationship with him. Because I think they both needed it.
Mm-hmm.
So my brothers, I like to think that I was the only one that had that kind of self-reflection, in the sense of, I was the only one who understood that something is very wrong here. This is not how things should be. And we have to change this. And then actively went about changing and breaking those cycles. But for my brothers, there was just kind of continuance. And so, two that I'm close with that are in Trinidad, both have alcohol problems. My father was an alcoholic as well. And so both of them drink a fair amount and both have been abusive to their wives and their kids. But what I'm seeing happening with them is a reflection and an understanding and communication between them and their spouses and their kids that this is not correct and you need to change and we can't continue this way and this is not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm seeing little by little that change happening, which was not able to happen with my dad. And so I'm very hopeful when I see stuff like that. It makes me excited to be working for Episcopal Relief and Development, work we do, but I can see how you have that, that self-reflection is so important when we talk about addressing gender-based violence, so important for perpetrators, for people who are abusive. When you really get them in conversations or there are certain situations that will prompt that, it makes a huge difference. And that's really what's needed. I mean, the economic empowerment, all of those things are super important. But a key component that is missing and we undervalue is that self-reflection.
No, and I mean, thanks for sharing all of that, Nicole. But I definitely agree with you. But yeah, I try to, you know, to be a good listener in these podcasts. So, but the listeners already know that I'm a fan of a philosopher called Ken Wilber, and you know, I simplify, you know, what he always says, but you know, that every issue, every problem has at least four perspectives, and that is I perspective, we, it, and its. And so even if you are working on process changes or structure changes, you can't do that with at least realizing that there is an I and we perspective. And we often forget that. And so I've experienced that in my work with Church World Service as well, that we thought, oh, we are so successful. And we realized, yes, we were successful in certain things, but then we forgot to pay attention to the I. And that is both for, you know, the one who's trying to facilitate the process, but also, you know, the folks that you work with. So yeah, we could do several podcasts about that. I would like to go back, if you don't mind.
Sure.
To then, that's amazing that you find a job where your, you know, boss becomes a kind of a mentor, and then, you know, you shift your profession, right? So can you take us through that? You know, you start studying, and then ultimately you decide to apply somewhere else. How did that go?
Yeah. So, I mean, we can never underestimate the values of mentors, and especially for women, having role models in the community that really support mm-hmm. and encourage you to live up to your potential, but also that ability to see that potential in you. I grew up in an environment where you really believe, or where I really believe that I wasn't enough and that I was not worthy. And so just having that in this one person was enough. So I, as I said, I did social work. And then I moved into doing psychology. So my first degree is actually in psychology, and I minored in gender and development. So my bachelor's degree is psychology. And again, it comes back to just wanting to help, but wanting to understand, wanting to be a good listener, wanting to be able to read and see the nuances. Because I think it's easy. We look at situations and we quickly judge it, but to take the time to really understand what is going on here, what is being asked, what is this person really saying is a skill that we really have to learn sometimes. Because I mean, I grew up in an environment being very much about my mom and what my mom is feeling and what she's going through, what she needs. And so there was never any focus on myself. It was just really about my mom and being and protecting her. And so being in that constant heightened state of anxiety also has its own health impacts, which could also be its own podcast as well. But yeah, so I did psychology. I minored in gender and development. And, you know, my boss, she understood if I wanted to come back to the banking, but she was like, this is not the space for you. Your talents are wasted here. And at that point, I knew, okay, in Trinidad, where could I utilize my skills? And so whilst I was at university doing my bachelor's, I did ethnographic research. And so I worked a lot with the Gender Institute. And I was part of a 4-year-long research that was funded by UNICEF that looked at child abuse and incest within communities in Trinidad and Tobago. And that was definitely a space I also grew up in and understood that and knew it was a huge problem. Didn't understand the extent of the problem until that delving into this research and how much that problem really was for Trinidad. And so that was amazing to really get me into this space of, hey, these are things I can do. This is where I could be of use and I could serve and I could help my community. And so during that time, you know, working on this research, I decided being part of the UN could be an option that I can think about. And so when I completed my bachelor's, I had called up the UN volunteer office in Trinidad just to see, you know, well, if there's anything, what's the process, how to go about it. There had been an opening at the time. They were looking for a gender researcher. And so it was just, you know, faith, the universe, you know, call it whatever you want, everything just sort of aligning in a way. And when I think back and look at my life, and sometimes I don't see it myself, but I have like my mentors who who just sort of remind me of how things have lined up and work that I've put in and the results it yielded. So even at university, I also in the Gender Institute had an amazing mentor there who, you know, knew the background I came from, knew the passion and that drove me to do the work that I do, and also was incredibly supportive to help me just continue in that space and build my skills. So I joined the UN as a gender researcher in Trinidad. I joined UNDP. And that was incredible, that experience. I started off doing gender mainstreaming and got to work across all different kinds of fields, just understanding the issues and challenges that women, men, boys and girls, the LGBTQI community, all that, you know, things that they face, realizing, but also finding a sense of solidarity. I remember at university, I started a feminist group called Consciousness Raising, and it brought together a bunch of women and men, mostly that were in my gender class, but just, you know, also within the university, who just had the same drive that we all want to do something about this problem of domestic violence. A lot of them coming from that space as well, and having those experiences. And we got together and we did such great activism on campus. And I thought, because for a long time, I thought, I'm so alone in this space. There's no one to talk to in a way. I mean, I had my brothers, but no one in a way that could say, okay, well, what can we do? How can we fix this? How can we start raising awareness at least? And then I found this group of amazing people, and I'm friends with all of them still to this day, who, you know, we you know, just have moved on and so forth, and the group is no longer. But it was just an amazing time in my life where I realized the magnitude of this problem, but also the amount of people working on it, which was both comforting and sad at the same time to realize. But yeah, all of that drove me to more and more just want to be in this space, because I realized there are things happening. People are working on this. These are things that we could do. So this is not just like a problem that there's no solution to. There are solutions, for sure. So yeah, that was my journey. And then so from there, when I worked with UNDP, I realized I have to build my knowledge more. And so yeah. I spent a little over a year with UNDP in Trinidad, and then decided I'm going to apply for my master's. And again, a lot of this was driven by my mentor during my university, saying there's more you can do. You're not done yet learning. And so I applied for my master's. I applied for scholarships because, of course, you know, I wasn't financially secure to be able to pay for university, especially for a master's program. And I got into a university in The Hague in the Netherlands. I went to the Institute of Social Studies, I did development. So my master's is in development studies, and I got a scholarship. I got a full scholarship from the Dutch government to do my studies there. And I met even more amazing people from the Global South, doing different kinds of work in different areas that just broadened my whole horizon. You know, coming this small little island to this huge global community and meeting people from all over really opened my eyes to the different problems, the ways people are addressing it, how people are navigating life and making choices. One of the biggest teachers in my life is listening to other people and very curious how they navigate their situations and challenges. And I learn a lot from that. And so that led me there. And I specialized in conflict and human security. And people were very curious about that. They were like, oh, but you come from this beautiful island. Why would you want to study conflict? I'm like, my entire region, my island is built on conflict, built on colonialization. We had three colonizers. So, you know, this is something like everything we're seeing now within the society that's so deeply embedded in terms of the violence and the dysfunctionalism has stemmed from, you know, from colonialism. And these, you know, that created all this trauma that has gone through generations. And so I want to understand that. I want to understand what conflict does to people on an individual level, but also on a national level too. What does it do to a people? And so my psychology degree partnered with my master's really sort of then further led me into the UN space. So after I finished my master's, I returned to Trinidad. I stayed there for a year. I continued work in research, continued doing ethnographic research. Like I said, this project had gone on for 4 years. So I was able to be part of that research project along the way at different stages, doing different parts of it, contributing to different parts of it. So that was amazing, amazing work. I love working with the community, being immersed in the community and just seeing, you know, from a research perspective, how the community is evolving and growing. And the different ways that it navigates and so forth. And then
ultimately you end up in the international world, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It was a year in Trinidad, and then I moved to Laos, where I worked with UNFPA originally. So I worked a lot on sexual rights and reproductive health. Yeah. And that was my entry into international space.
And I would like to go relatively quickly through that, because, you know, yeah, for people that work in our field in the NGO world and the UN, is, I mean, many of them, and they might deny it, but I know it is, you know, it is a truth, is that the UN, a job with the UN ultimately is, you know, then you work in the Premier League in a way,
yeah.
You know, for all kinds of reasons. But then you go back. I mean, you go back, you go to Episcopal, yeah. You know, in the beginning. Why is that? Why didn't you stay with the UN and continue? You know, yeah. the pensions are better. You know, financially, you're talking about in the beginning, you know, finance is an important thing. You can take care of yourself. And now financially you take probably a step back. We don't have to go into details, but that's talk us through that. How did that happen and why?
I think it's because one, people don't understand how the contract system works in the UN. Mm-hmm. So I never had the real Premier League contract of having the pension and all the benefits. I started off as a UN volunteer, so it's a paid volunteer system, but that paid volunteer, that payment was the equivalent, like that it was, you were paid in US, so the equivalent of that was, it turned out equivalent of that was much more than I was making in Trinidad. And I spent 10 plus years in that space, but never got a proper contract. And different agencies operate different ways. So you have your kind of Premier League agencies like UNDP, UNICEF, but then, you know, I did a lot of work with UN Women, and they're much more of a younger agency, not as huge a budget as other agencies. And I think people don't often understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of my work with UN Women was under a consultancy contract. So the contract modality doesn't matter so much in terms of the kind of work you do. Mm-hmm. So you still operated as like a proper full-time fixed term employee, but just not paid that worth. But that wasn't necessarily, that wasn't the reason that mm-hmm. I left. I mean, I stayed for 10 years with that kind of salary and those kinds of unstable conditions. What I noticed is people were just getting more and more sort of dissociated from the work, and it became so much more about the bureaucracy and so much more about the business side of things rather than the human side of things. So I say sometimes that, you know, we've just lost the humanness in our humanitarian work. And you see that now, like when I think about what I'm struggling with in the humanitarian and development space, is that it's become so much of a business for a profit. And we're not really about helping people anymore, like getting them out of this. Like, this work should not be forever. We should be, you know, there are real solutions to these problems. And I feel sometimes that we're just perpetuating the problem to people to continue having jobs. And we're not really about trying to find real solutions that can end these issues. When we think of like hunger, homelessness, violence, etc., there are answers to these problems. But that, you know, the inequality that we see in the world, and it's rampant even within the UN. I became really disillusioned in this space, that I came into this system, like a lot of people who joined the UN, wanting to be a good and positive force in the world and to serve and be, you know, of service to your community. And to your global community, and then just realizing that is not what this space is about anymore. maybe at one time, maybe never. Maybe we have that illusion from the outside and you come in and you see that it's not that way. I didn't get to really work with communities anymore. And I felt like I was becoming disconnected from reality, what's going on the ground. And I was just very unhappy. The salary part of things was just another layer to it. But, you know, it was really more about this is not meaningful work anymore. I'm just working for the sake of working.
And why do you think, Nicole, that Episcopal Relief and Development will be, you know, providing you with that?
That is an excellent question. Just also because I'm not a religious person. I have a very contentious relationship with organized religion. I'm a very spiritual person. I believe deeply in spirituality. But I get very nervous around organized religion. And I think this is a lot to do, again, stemming from colonialism and the way religion was used in a manipulative way to convert people, etc. And so, you know, you develop this idea that it's not a good thing. But then growing in my own space and understanding how faith actors work, meeting different people who are deeply religious, who go to church regularly, who are very practicing their faith religiously, seeing a different side to it, meeting different people who acknowledge the church isn't perfect, we have our issues. But, you know, there are certainly good parts of it. And I definitely agree with that. There are beautiful, beautiful parts of the church and beautiful parts of religion. And you see genuine people who really believe we are here to serve and we're here to do good. When I applied for the Episcopal job, I never thought I would be shortlisted or anything. It was a director level job. And I felt, again, those feelings of not being worthy, et cetera, coming back like, okay, I don't. Too much, it's too high level for me. I'll give it a shot to apply because you don't apply, you don't have a chance. But I never thought I'd get it. And it was the first job after applying to so many that actually wrote back and said, you've been shortlisted for an interview. And then I eventually got it. And for me, it came down to two jobs. It was between Episcopal Relief and Development and another organization. And I chose Episcopal because I really very much believe in what they do. I really do believe, even not being a religious person or having my own doubts about religion on the whole, I understand and value very much the role religious actors, religious communities, faith leaders have in addressing gender-based violence. You require a holistic, multi-sectoral approach. Everyone has to be at the table because you have to look at your whole ecosystem. You can't exclude anyone in addressing the problem. And I think in the UN, especially working in the Libya-Tunisia context, we get a little bit weary and cautious of working with religious actors. Sometimes we're not sure. We know we have to include them. And I've met now so many people within the UN system who are like, definitely, I want to work with you all. I want to do stuff with you all. And there is a space. And even many of them have said to me, I'm not religious, Nicole, but I know that they have to be there. And that's how I think about it as well. And I love the work they do. And if I could talk a little bit about one project that we have that has become very near and dear to my heart. It's a work we've done in Liberia for the past 8 years. And it's, you know, very collaborative work with our partners. It takes an interfaith approach, which I love very much. So it's not just about, you know, Episcopalians working together, but we work with Islamic Relief USA. And it's very much about empowering and educating faith leaders across religious lines to have reflective discussions about entrenched harmful social and gender norms, root causes and consequences, linking that to religious texts that may underpin these practices, and then allows them, you know, helping them, supporting them to then use scriptures that promote gender equality and justice during their sermons and other faith-based activities, example, marriage counseling. And we use this particular tool, and at CSW, we had such a wonderful experience with this Commission on the Status of Women that just happened a few weeks ago, as you know. It's called FAMA cards, F-A-M-A. So it stands for Facts, Association, Meaning, and Action cards. And it really is these cards, really simple, low cost, nothing major costing about this, to help religious faith leaders have a self-reflective, self-discovery journey on what they've learned, what they've grown up with, what could be harmful about it, how they can then change, but identifying with what is wrong with this, where does this resonate with me? And then thinking about more at a deeper level, where did this come from and how can I change this? Is this actually true? And again, it comes back to that whole belief I have that that reflection, being able to have that space to reflect, helps so much and is such a key component to changing these harmful behaviors that we see. And we've had amazing, amazing results in Liberia with this. So, for example, we've seen a decrease in intimate partner violence experienced by women from 41% to 33% on average across four counties. We've seen a decrease in men's intimate partner violation perpetration in three out of the four counties. We've seen a decrease in adolescent boys' perpetration across all counties. We've seen improvements in anti-violence against women and gender equitable attitudes from all groups, men, women, adolescent boys, girls. So, for example, the percentage of boys rejecting rape myth increased from 47% to 75% at the end of that project. And we've seen an increased knowledge of available violence against women services. So women reported knowing about violence against women services have increased from 48 to 86%. An increase of percentage of amongst girls and their own knowledge about violence against women, and that doubled from 41 to 79%. And now what we're doing is taking the lessons learned successes from Liberia and contextualizing that to the DRC to support an expansion of this project. And our idea is to have a regional project. So, you know, looking at Kenya, Burundi, et cetera, to bring on board next. This is amazing work. And this is a testimony to what I believe has been missing from the UN approach. And in talking with many UN actors, from UN women in particular, we see that so much. We value that. That's not what faith-based actors can do, is something the UN can't do. Faith-based actors have that connection to the community. They're trusted. They are oftentimes on the front line of issues with violence, of issues with disaster risk. They're the ones that are there supporting and helping the community, trying to find resources, provide shelter. So they're an important component in that whole ecosystem of addressing violence. And we cannot discount that, no matter what our feelings might be about religion. We cannot discount the importance of faith-based actors in that space.
No, thanks for lifting up that project. And from where I'm sitting, I really appreciate it. I mean, I'm you know that at the moment I have two hats. I work for Church World Service close to 25 years, a faith-based organization, and I have the honor of leading another organization as an interim in charge, JLI, that really works on the space, on the nexus of religion and development, and looks at, you know, coming up with data to show that what we do makes an impact or not. So, you know, they published a report, JLI, called the State of the Evidence Report. They're working now on the second edition of that. And, you know, I mean, you're critical of the UN. I can be critical about many of the FBOs, of the faith-based organizations, that don't necessarily, you know, show the world, you know, how they're making an impact. And if you know, there needs to be that marriage of religion and development. So JLI is helping there as a translator. So this is great. I applaud it. And Nicole, these conversations always go fast. There are a couple of things that I always, you know, want to ask, because this is a spin-off of a 100-mile walk, you know, that I've been doing since 2012. So if you can bear with me, sure. You know, maybe we do them in a little bit of a rapid fire type of, framework. A couple of questions that I would like to ask you. Yeah, I think we talked a lot about mental health, and so I think, you know, music can be really helpful there. So and regardless, I always have a question about music anyway, because it's so close to me. So if I ask you to come up with a piece of music or a song that, you know, embodies for a big part who you are, who Nicole is, which song or piece of music would that be? And why?
Oh, well, coming from the Caribbean, it's definitely Bob Marley. Redemption Song is very, well, all his music is near and dear to me, but Redemption Song is always something I come back to from because of the line, emancipate yourself from mental slavery, none but ourselves can free our minds. Knowledge is power. The more you know, the more you can do, the more you understand, the more empathy you have, the more you are able to listen, the more you're able to have compassion, the more these walls can break down. Sorry, I'm getting emotional about it. I feel that it's a powerful song. It means so many different things to different people. I feel it's such a hopeful song because I really believe that what is missing in our world right now, what we're seeing is just an increasing lack of empathy, a disconnection, a polarization. And we're just forgetting at the root of it. We're all human beings. With the same blood running through our veins, the same body, same makeup. You know, we have different color skins, but that is just to highlight, like, we look at difference and we see the negativity in it. We use it to divide us rather than to bring us together and just remind us how beautiful we are as human beings and the wonderful things we're capable of. And that song, just that line in that song just constantly reminds me of the people along my journey that has really been like, there's so much potential in you. There's, you know, you've got to learn more. You've got to do more. There's so much you can do in the world. And I feel a lot of it has to do with just unlearning what we've grown up with that becomes our own barriers. As he says, you know, none but ourselves can free our mind. That's not somebody else's job. It's our own. And I think my journey has been doing that, just unlearning everything I grew up with to become the person I am today.
Yeah, and I love Bob Marley as well. And actually, we've had previous guests who also picked Bob Marley. And I think at least one picked a Redemption Song. So that says something, right? And I've had many guests. It's very fortunate. So, you know, that will be added, that song, to a playlist that I've developed on Spotify, hashtag Walk Talk Listen, and you can find all the songs that were selected. And for me, it's awesome. If I listen to that, it reminds me, the awesome conversations that I had. And you know, it's classical music, reggae, R&B, name it. Nicole, you talking about, you know, the empathy, that's not something that it's almost seems at times something that we have lost. I would like to link it with a quick question about the sustainable development goals and the inner development goals. What I would like to let the listeners always know is, you know, as a world, we developed the sustainable development goals to make this world better. It's focusing on system and structure changes that are required. It's not perfect, but it's there. And I think we need to use it. So my question to my guest is, you know, what do you like to the listeners to know about the SDGs, and again, if you can do that in a tweet type of comment, that would be great. And then the second part is I do think one of the reasons why we are, you know, only at 15% on average in reaching those goals that we should reach in 2030 is that we did not pay proper attention, or we are not paying proper attention to the skills, abilities, and knowledge that you need as an individual and as a community. And I do think the inner development goals that have been developed are useful, because it looks at, you know, being, thinking, relating, collaborating, and acting, five goals that were identified, and then says, you know, you need to work on your empathy. You need to work on critical thinking. And I always say that, you know, people are laughing. You know, I used to have a six pack, but I had to train for that. Now I have a one pack, but even for that one pack, I need to train the muscles, right? So, so our inner thing, you know, your critical thinking, your empathy, if you don't train that, then yeah, you're going to lose it. So, yeah, any quick comments around the SDGs and IDUs from your side?
The SDGs in theory are really amazing goals to help us all sort of reach a certain level equitably. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, like, equity and inequality are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the SDGs came about because looking at the state of the world, different countries, we're not all at the same level. You have your least income countries, your lower income countries, your high income countries, your developed countries, your less developed countries. We have that division. But that is how things work in a capitalist system. Someone has to be more, someone has to be less. That is how capitalism works and operates. And the idea behind the SDGs was to bring about a certain amount of equity amongst countries. And there's very good intention behind it on basic things like education, gender equality, climate, etc. In theory, they're very beautiful goals in that way. And that's what I would want people to know, to understand that there's good intention behind it. But as you said, what is, again, missing from it is the human side of it. So we've sort of, you know, economically put into a nice framework where we all need to be. But no one, there was no thinking behind, does everybody have the skill to get there? Because it's not about our GDP needs to be at a certain, you know, percentage to say that we're working well. And you find now even people, some countries not measuring GDP the same way in economic terms. Some people are more concerned about how happy is my people, like Bhutan, for example. Their GDP is on happiness, based on happiness. Are my people content? Are they my good leader? Are they able to live well, all of them, not just some? So, you know, and I think a way the UN tried to humanize that was to then talk about leave no one behind. And that's an amazing principle that I fully agree with, I'm fully on board with. Cannot leave anyone behind. But again, we're not thinking about those human components, that human development that you're talking about, the empathy and that interpersonal growth to be able to just get there. Because, you know, it's not about we have these, because as you said, we're doing very poorly on it. 2030 is our deadline, and we're struggling to get there. And unless we start addressing the things that are holding us back internally, why we're so divided now more than I can ever remember. Why is that? What is happening? We cannot move forward individually. We have to move forward collectively. There is no reason that we all can't be equal, that we all can't enjoy the same benefits. And me having benefits doesn't take away from you having benefits. But there is very much this polarized thinking that we cannot operate together, and that equality is not for everybody. It's only for some people. And these certain benefits are only for some people, not for some. Until we get past that, until we can see that that's not the case, there's always going to be that struggle. And then, you know, what comes after the SDGs? And I'm very much a proponent for the SDGs. We need to have something, some indicator, some measurement of things to work towards. And we all need to be, all the countries at a certain level. But in doing so, we need to understand, well, why is this country a lesser developed country? What does it not have that other countries who are more developed have? And then how can we help that country elevate? But also looking at the different ways people see elevation. Mm. And then I go back to Bhutan, like, maybe it's not about I need to be the richest financial country. Maybe I'm more concerned about, are my people happy?
Mm.
That's how I see it.
And do you think that the inner development goals can, you know, are a good tool then, or an addition to the SDGs?
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, I never heard of the inner development goals until this podcast. Uh-huh. I was able to do some research, and they're amazing. They're amazing. The five dimensions with 23 skills for a human inner growth and development, that is the component that has been missing from this whole development. This is the humanization that I've been saying that we miss in the UN, that we're not thinking about, that we're forgetting. And or not even forgetting, but we just sort of, you know, brush it aside. There's no place for that. We've taken the human component out of humanitarian work, and then we wonder why we're doing so poorly. Why are we not moving forward? And we're just not. We become so disconnected from our reality and from what's going on the ground, what's going on in the field, what's going on in other people's lives, that we just we don't see that what has been missing has been these five dimensions with 23 skills. I definitely think that it is a very key component that needs to be addressed to get us moving forward. And if we can get major actors to pay attention to it, to major countries like the UN to take this on board in a real way and understand it needs to work hand in hand together to get us moving collectively together forward, we would see a real change. And maybe then that's the next step when they've realized in 2030, well, we still didn't achieve. What's missing? Maybe there'll be people at the table at that point saying, hey, there were these inner development goals. Maybe we need to think, how do they marry? Where do they fit together? And we could see that kind of leadership coming out, that kind of drive. That's what we need to see now.
Yeah, that would be great from my perspective. So, no, thanks for that. You know, these conversations always go fast. I still would like to ask you the following question, and that is, what I hope, you know, I think during COVID, we realized that we are interconnected, at least for 2 weeks. We realized that, and then when some of us got access to the vaccine, you know, that was thrown overboard in a way. But I do think that if we realize that more on a daily basis, and we start listening more and better to each other, we can work towards a world that is, you know, better for everybody. So, you know, I hope that, you know, I'm connecting my guests with the listeners. I also try to connect my guests with other guests. So I always have a question of the previous guest for, you know, the current guest. And the question for you of the previous guest, Nicole, is,
what one thing would you have you found it's been the most important for you to unlearn in order to see and be a bit different in the world, the way you want to be rather than the way it, you've always been or it's always? What do you want to unlearn, or what are you unlearning?
You're right. I have alluded to it. It's and that was such a great question. I thought really got me thinking. I think for me personally, it would be that I've had to unlearn that I am unworthy, and understand that I am worthy, that I am born enough. Because you know, when you, and I saw that for a great portion of my life, navigating just constantly being insecure and the way you hold yourself back because you just think, I don't belong in these spaces. And Viola Davis had said, an African-American actress had said, we come out of our mother's womb born worthy. We already have it. It's already there. All our skills, everything we need is within us. We just have to tap into it. We have to listen to our inner brain, and we have to connect with it. And so much of the world and how the world operates right now is to get us to be disconnected and to get us to be in this space. Like I said, you know, we put so many things in place to measure our worth and you know, constantly making us feel like we're insecure and we need this thing to function, and we don't. We have everything we need within us. And it's been a journey, and I'm still on that journey of just unlearning that and realizing that I am worthy, I am enough, I belong in this space. And I wish that for everyone that I come in contact with. No matter my feelings, personal feelings about them, that's what I wish for everybody, that if we knew that. And I think if we knew that individually, I just think of the collective power that we could tap into to just elevate our spiritual energy and get us to see beyond these barriers and walls that we've put up in thinking we need to protect ourselves. And we would feel so much more connected to each other.
Your question for the next guest.
My question for the next guest would be, what role do you believe storytelling and personal narratives play in fostering empathy and understanding towards displaced communities and migrants, particularly in today's global context?
Okay, great question. Before, you know, I thank you. Is there a question that I did not ask that I should have asked today?
No, I think we covered so many things in a short time.
Yes, and my apologies, you know, for pushing, you know, I really enjoyed and thank you for telling your story. I know that it will be really helpful for so many people. I know for a fact that it is, because, you know, one of the reasons that I invited you is that I did not see you speak during the Commission on the Status of Women 68, because I was recording a lot of different podcasts, but people that I trust, they told me you need to speak with her. So I know that you sharing your story is helping a lot of will help a lot of people. So I would like to thank you for that. I wish you all the best with Episcopal Relief and Development. I think it's a great organization. I know our paths will continue to cross because, as long as I'm involved with Church World Service and JLI, I hope we will do work together even. So let's maybe put that on our agendas to get that done. Thank you so much. All the best and really thank you for sharing your story and your wisdom.
Thank you very much for listening and for inviting me and having me on your podcast. And to all your viewers listening, I hope something resonated. Please feel free to reach out. I'm always happy to talk with people. I'm also happy to listen to people's stories. It's one of my favorite things to do. So thank you so much for just having me in this space.
Great. And we will make some links available via the podcast notes. So thanks a lot, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Maurice. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you for listening to Walk, Talk, Listen. Please check us out on 100mile.org or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.